Paris Matthews, and this is the Tell Me the Truth About Life podcast. Poems that matter and why. It's launched for National Poetry Day's 25th anniversary. I love to champion poetry because when someone shares a poem with you, it gives you an insight both into the person who shared it with you and the world we live in. In this podcast series, author Michael Mopurgo, Instagram poet Nikita Gill, actor Jay DeNuca, teacher Kate Clancy, and comedian Henry Normal each take us on a tour of their Touchstone poems, in conversation here with Susanna Herbert of the Forward Arts Foundation. All these contributors feature in the anthology I've curated. It's called Tell Me the Truth About Life, a National Poetry Day anthology, 100 Poems That Matter. It's published by Michael O'Mara Books to celebrate the 25th anniversary of National Poetry Day. I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, my name is Susanna Herbert and I run the charity behind National Poetry Day. For the next half hour, I'm talking to the poetry champion Henry Normal. You may know him as the genius comedy writer behind the shows The Royal Family, Mrs. Merton, Coogan's Run, just a few of the hits he brought into the world. With Steve Coogan, he founded the production company Baby Cow, and together they won huge audiences, BAFTAs and Oscar nominations. And yet, very few of the millions who love Henry's comedy know that his real passion is writing poems. He started age 14 and says he first realised poetry's power to communicate when he heard Roger McGough at his local theatre in Nottingham. A career as a performance poet followed. He toured with the Sheffield band Pulp, set up festivals, released an album. And then, about 20 years ago, everything changed. How did fatherhood change your approach to poetry?
Well, I wrote poetry when I was young, and then I wanted to get into poetry, and the only way I could do that was by what you might call comedy cabaret. And so I managed to do, I think, over 1,000 gigs at places like jazz clubs, folk clubs. I toured with Pulp, the band Pulp, to, you know, pop concerts and things like that. So I did all this with this vague idea that I would somehow become a popular poet, you know, in the style of these great people that I've mentioned. And I got drawn into comedy, is the thing, because it paid more. So I was given a comedy series when I went up to Edinburgh, and then Caroline Ahern asked me to write the Mrs. Merton show with her, and Steve asked me to write his early stuff, Paul Carf and Coogan's Run. And so I found I was actually doing two lots of writing. I was writing for Steve and writing for Caroline, and they were both at the top of the game. And so I was writing at weekends, lunchtimes, night times, to try and write for both. So I spent 10 years head down writing. So I didn't write any poems. So when we set up Baby Cow, Steve and I, again, I became a producer and was working flat out. And very soon after we set up Baby Cow, my son was born, Johnny, and I felt I needed to earn enough money to make sure that we were secure. So I sort of sacrificed the poetry in a way. When he was 2.5, we found out that Johnny was autistic. And that took up a lot of our time trying to, bring him into this world, because he was very much in a world of his own. But then once we'd found a way of getting the best out of Johnny and getting the best out of ourselves in a lifestyle that we could all be happy, I got my head up and I thought I'd like to communicate something of this journey. The first poem I wrote after about oh my goodness, 20-odd years, was a poem about my son. And it was from a photograph, because I got all these photographs, as we take photographs of kids now in a way that we never had photographs. We've got thousands of them. But I had these photographs, and some of them made me laugh, and some of them made me cry, and some of them made me angry. And I was looking at this image, because it's essentially an image in the same way we use images in poetry. And I was thinking, why is this giving me such a strong feel? Why is this image giving me so? What am I reading into this image? And it's this thing about truth. It is, I wanted to know. For me, if nobody else ever read this poem, I wanted to know, to communicate to myself, what was the truth of my reaction to this image. So I wrote a poem called "Photos with My Son," that opened the floodgates then. I don't even know if I thought it was going to be a poem. I just wanted to write something, and it was quite a short piece. I can read it for you if you can find it. And then I got lots of other photographs, and I started writing about those. And my wife, Angela and Johnny, would go on a Saturday morning. They would go to town. And that was a regular thing. Johnny likes routine. So I always had Saturday morning, because I was working during the week, and I had Saturday morning free. And so essentially for about a year, on Saturday mornings, I sat and wrote poems whilst Angela and Johnny were walking around town. And it was such a release, and it was such a joy to express something of myself and of the inner life that we as a family were having, that I've never looked back since then. I've written constantly, and probably too many poems, more poems than strictly speaking necessary, Mrs. Merton would say.
I love the idea of the necessary poem.
Yes. I'll read you that poem, if you like. "Photos with My Son." Johnny is not interested in having his photo taken. When prompted, he will look at the lens. His hand is likely to move at any moment. I suspect he's not sure what is expected of him. "Smile," he says. He doesn't smile. He just says "smile," echoing the words from behind the camera. I still get very emotional even now reading some of these, which means that they have significance for me.
It's a kind of time travel, isn't it? The nearest you can get to being in somebody else's skin.
It's quite funny how you can find that in your own work, and then somebody else will have a thought that encapsulates something you're feeling. And now, how Shelley encapsulated the world of fame and modern media and that back in his day, I don't know. But having worked with film stars and media people of all kinds, Ozymandias is the best poem about fame and about power and about people having this larger view of themselves that I've ever read, and or any set of words to shed any light on it. So, can I read that? This is Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley. "I met a traveller from an antique land who said, 'Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculpture well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear: 'My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair.' Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
I always wonder what happened to the sculptor, whether he whether he survived.
I love the fact I'm at the moment I'm doing this show about the universe for radio, so it's called A Normal Universe. So I'm looking at the universe from different points of view, and I'm looking at evolution, and there's this view of evolution that it's a straight line, and of course, if you put Shakespeare into that, his grandchildren died without having kids, so. You could put him outside of, you know, in your sort of, you know, sort of reptile, ape, man. His DNA won't go on. And yet he's left something, which is quite interesting in a way. So this idea of a line, I find, is sort of wrong. We're not going to one place. We're going to lots of different places in all directions, and we're picking up from those who don't make the journey. And whether we're people, I mean, I won't have, my son won't have kids. That's my only similarity with Shakespeare, by the way. the thought process of what it is as a species, what it is as a human, is that we pick up, for me, we pick up from those that falter. We pick up from those that are that have come and gone, that are no longer here. And so these poems and all the communications that we pass to each other, it is like a relay race that we're giving to the people that do go on, you know, these little snippets. And I quite like that. Because, as I say, I won't have any interest in another 100 years. I'll have no... I have no ulterior motive beyond helping people, you know, whose species I share.
I think at some point before the written word, poetry was the main way of communicating between generations because it could be remembered and passed on. Yeah. And I notice this a bit when I talk to kids who come from faraway countries and they don't have much in their pockets. They probably don't have pockets. They've got stuff in their heads,
yeah,
which they've got from their grandmothers, and there might be songs, there might be sayings.
Well, we use them all the time, don't we? So there's a lot of poems that that appear, you know, at funerals and weddings and things like that. I got a poem that I wanted to read you that was something I picked up on the television. I was watching The World at War, and Sir Laurence Olivier read this poem, and they were talking about the Russian front and the fact that in the stories we tell us, sometimes we don't tell the full story. The Russians lost so many more people than the Western Allies. There's all sorts of stories that we were talking about India a second ago. The Indian Army was the biggest volunteer army ever in history. We don't retell these stories as much, and they had an episode of The World at War which was about the Russian front, and I thought it was great that I understood the world contribution, and there was a poem that he read that it was by Konstantin Simonov, it had a great effect on me, and it was a sort of poem that exists outside of books. It exists in being passed from person to person, and I can imagine at the time in the Second World War when this was written that it would have had a great effect on the Russians, called Wait For Me. Wait for me and I'll return, only wait very hard. Wait when you are filled with sorrow and as you watch the yellow rain. Wait when the wind sweeps the snowdrifts. Wait in the sweltering heat. Wait when others have stopped waiting, forgetting their yesterdays. Wait even when from afar no letters come to you. Wait even when others are tired of waiting. Wait for me and I'll return, but wait patiently. Wait even when you're told that you should forget. Wait even when my mother and son think I'm no more. Wait when friends sit around the fire drinking to my memory. Wait and do not hurry to drink to my memory too. Wait for me in our return, defying every death. And let those who do not wait say, I was lucky. They will never understand that in the midst of death, you, with your waiting, save me. Only you and I will know how I survived. It was because you waited, as no one else did.
That is an extraordinary poem.
That's a great poem.
Yeah. And it has an element of surprise, and it shows the surviving. It shows the surviving within it. The fact that you're now reading it aloud, evidently moved, as I think anybody cannot fail to be.
What I love about it is it's about an individual, but it's about everybody. And when you think of the numbers of people that died, and you know, in this case, the numbers of Russians, but that could be written by any nationality, and the awful weight. But also, that could be almost about anybody who's died, or anybody who is away. It's just about loss, and I think there's something gorgeous about that. Loss is one of those things that in any other form other than poetry, it's very difficult to put over the emotion and the essence of it. And we sort of need poetry in a way to help us come to terms with it. I've a couple of poems that I'd like to read of mine, if I may.
Please do.
Which, again, encapsulate this. So I wrote a poem in my late teens about a girl. So this is "The House Is Not the Same Since You Left." The house is not the same since you left. The cooker is angry. It blames me. The TV tries desperately to stay busy, but occasionally I catch it staring out of the window. The washing up's feeling sorry for itself again. It just sits here saying, what's the point? What's the point? The curtains count the days. Nothing in the house will talk to me. I think your armchair's dead. The kettle tried to come for me at first, but you know what its attention span's like. I've not told the plants yet. They still think you're on holiday. The bathroom misses you. I hardly see it these days. It still can't believe you didn't take it with you. The bedroom won't even look at me. Since you left, it keeps its eyes closed. All it wants to do is sleep, remembering better times, trying to lose itself in dreams. It seems it's taken the easy way out, but at night I hear the pillows, weeping into the sheets.
Oh.
Now, I wrote that about a girl I was very much in love with, but it's actually been read at funerals. And it's interesting to me that it has, because obviously it's about loss. I do find it nice that it's read at funerals, because this idea of loss is very much, you know, it's all to do with love.
It's universal, and we don't have the language for it. So sometimes you need other people's words.
Yeah, and what I was trying to do with this was to make it every day, to make it come down to my life, as opposed to this, you know, windswept vistas and, you know, sort of epic imagery. This is the language of my day, as it were.
You've domesticated it and made it real. So you've got, you're talking about the effect of poetry on other people. You started off by talking about the effect of poetry on you.
Yeah.
But you've done a hell of a lot, really, in making poetry speak to more people, because you founded the Manchester Poetry Festival, and you've also founded much more recently, 5 years ago, I think, the Nottingham Poetry Festival. What have you noticed about the way in which people flock to these poetry events? What's changing?
Well, The reason why I started the one in Manchester 25 years ago was that Lem Sisse and I used to tour, but we'd always be in rural places. So you'd go to Ledbury or Aeon Y, and yet there we were living in Manchester as urban poets, and a lot of the poets that we would work with, Benjamin Zephaniah, and you know, a lot of the other poets, John Cooper Clarke, say they were all urban poets. So I thought, well, we should have a poetry festival in an urban place, and try to make it that's as poetic as if it was elsewhere. So I started off. I'd done a television show that I wasn't very happy with. It was called Packet of Three, and I did some poetry on it, but I was a little bit like Bernie Winters. Well, to be honest with you, I was a little bit like Snorbits. It's probably a better, or even Mike Winters. I thought I was that unfunny. That's a reference for the older people. I had a lot of money from doing television. I wanted it to make somebody happy, because it wasn't making me happy. So I got about £3,000, and I said to a friend of mine, Rick Michael, who was he didn't like poetry at all. He was a rock promoter. I said, I want to do this. Will you help me do it? And so he put up fly-posted posters in the middle of the night, these huge, you know, like it was a rock gig. And we put on 10 days of events, and I got everybody, got Carcanet and, you know, all the green room in the corner house and all the different elements of Manchester to come and join in. And the first event was Tony Harrison, who I'm a big fan of. But I always put on a big poet, like Tony, and then a local poet, and at the time, as a 19-year-old, it was Lem Sisse, who's obviously become a big poet. But that was always the intention, that you would grow the local poets within this arena. It was an absolute success. So I did it for about 4 or 5 years, and my claim to fame, as it were, but certainly the best moment was we had Seamus Heaney came over. I think it was just the second day after he'd won the Nobel Prize. I think he stayed for a day, and then he came over. And so he flew direct from Scandinavia, and he came to Manchester Airport. And we put him on at the Whitworth Art Gallery in Manchester, and there was about 300 people. So picked him up from the station. I said to him, look, I've got you about £1,000 for the performance. And he said, you haven't got cash, have you? And he got a check, because when you win the Nobel Prize, you get a check for about £1 million, not quite £1 million. But he got that in his pocket, but he got no cash.
Oh.
So we had to go to a till and get him some cash out. So that he could, and we got to the Whitworth Art Gallery, and as he walked in the door, everyone stood up. And applauded him, so this was him coming, you know, to Britain for the first time, so that was a bit of history, and that was gorgeous, and to have been able to be a part of that was a glorious thing.
Yeah, and to help him out with cash for his bus.
Yes, and then and of course he was great.
We discovered that what people often need is a bit of signposting. So, what would be your top tip to somebody who says, I'm looking for poems that might suit me?
Well, I think you see you lend your different poems on different days. So if I'm because I'm doing something about the universe, I think you need to be more specific. So I might I was looking at infinity recently as a concept. It's quite a weird concept, infinity. It's a man-made concept. So I might type in poems about infinity. And that will give me something that's more in tune with where my head is at the moment. You can't just type poetry in. It's more specific than that. There's too much poetry in the world. It's like typing music in. How can you do that? I bet you've got albums where you'll listen to some albums if you're in one mood, and some albums if you're in another mood. I always remember Cat Stevens had two brilliant albums. He had Tea for the Tillerman and Teaser and the Firecat. One was about romance, and the other one was about sense of identity. And when I was 16, 17, I would play them both. If I was feeling like I wanted a girlfriend, I would play one. If I was feeling like I needed to, find myself, I would play the other. You know, it's no good even typing Cat Stevens in. You had to type in Teaser and the Firecat or, T for the Tillerman. You need to be more specific. It's that thing of treating poetry as one. It's a million things. And all the better for it.
It's a million things because we're a million things.
Yes.
It strikes me that one of the reasons poetry is becoming much more popular and evident in the world around us now is that people are a bit less scared of identifying themselves as somebody who occasionally writes a poem.
What I like to do is, because I'm a fairly sort of... ordinary man in the sense that somebody might look at me and just think, well, an ordinary bloke, not anything special. And yet, if I do a poem and I do a very emotional poem, I would hope that they go, well, in that case, I'm allowed to do an emotional poem. I'm allowed to be sensitive, because we have had this strange cultural thing over the years where if you go back just one generation, men wouldn't be British men, that is, wouldn't be that emotional in public. And I think we're getting better at that. Men now hug, don't they? I think younger men are probably more liberated in that respect.
Your father's generation, you wouldn't have talked of, have found your dad's friends down the pub talking about poems.
My dad would never say "I love you," but he would make you sandwiches. Right, so he would do it in a physical sense. That was saying "I love you." He would do things for you. The last words he ever said to me was "put your hat on," which means "I love you." But he's saying "put your hat on" because it might be raining outside. And that was the way there were. I think poetry, because it's to do with the emotion, probably then in that old scenario was thought not to be for us, because we're men who take all the pressure and don't show it. The old sort of Clint Eastwood, the man with no name, we're silent, but we do what's needed to be done. Whereas hopefully now we're in a situation where the communicating is part of what needs to be done. Because we do need to, they say the thought is the mother to the deed. We do need, whether it be politics or in personal lives, we do need to communicate lots of things. And if you know somebody else, if you can empathise with somebody else, if you can understand where they're coming from, it changes the world in a profound way.
It's as active for the reader or the listener as the maker, though, because you've just translated what your father said in a way that is very vivid. Yeah. He didn't directly say anything like "I love you," which might sound a bit cheesy anyhow, because those words are used all the time and they're not properly meant. He said something which could be read as "I love you."
Well, he's using poetry.
Exactly. I was thinking of the Emily Dickinson, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant." On that note, I think I should thank Henry for talking to us about his contribution to Tell Me the Truth About Life, which is an anthology crowdsourced from the public. We put out a call and said, send in some poems that mean something to you, that touch on truth. And Henry, as you can tell, could have sent in enough poems to fill the entire book. So we're obviously going to have to go through to volumes 2, 3, right up to 600, I think, at this rate. But the idea that you can paint a picture, take the nation's temperature through the poems it chooses, is quite appealing. And I think that what we've discovered, from your choice, Henry, is the idea that there is a place for poetry in the public square and also in the privacy of your own heart. And those aren't two separate places. We belong in both. So thank you again, Henry, for talking to us about your great love of poetry. And I'm going to ask you to read one more poem and to introduce it.
If I may, I'll read the one that's most requested of mine, if that's okay. Again, it's about the idea of saying the thing that most needs to be said. So when I found out my son was autistic, I went to a psychiatrist. The idea as a working class lad of going to a psychiatrist, very strange idea. And the psychiatrist said to me that he'd been in business for 30 years and had, in all that time, everyone had the same problem that came to him. And I thought, this is a bit suspect. I didn't quite believe that. And he said, everybody thinks they're not good enough. So this is a prayer for the hesitant. A pale blue dot amid a family portrait. This is your home planet. You are where you were born to be. Breathe. The world is your living room. You are amongst friends. Your ancestors, your family, and over 10,000 saints look down. Nobody means you any harm, not even God or nature. You can choose not to fear. The universe expects nothing. Every single thing is more than nothing. You have already exceeded expectation. If you forget me, my name, this moment, remember only this. You are good enough. Imperfect as we are, you are good enough.
Tell Me the Truth About Life is published to coincide with the 25th anniversary of National Poetry Day on October the 3rd, 2019. It's published in association with National Poetry Day and Michael O'Mara.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and share it. Or better still, find a poem that speaks truth to you and let me, Keris Matthews, know what it is on Twitter using hashtag TellMeTheTruthAboutLife.